Mr. Mike Cranston, so great to have you here in the Beaver Bank Bunker.
I can't tell you how impressed I am with the Beaver Bank Bunker, and I know that some people call it the Beetle Bank Bunker for obvious reasons. You have to have the largest collection of Beetle memorabilia in the world in here.
Well, thank you.
Really, it's phenomenal.
Now, there are some people who would argue that point, but but I like it.
Yeah.
I'm actually just using it to, it buffers the sound.
Well, I'm expecting to see Paul McCartney walk through the door any minute.
Mike Cranston, I loved your work in Breaking Bad. I think that was terrific. And a lot of people don't realize that you were also in Malcolm in the Middle.
That's right. Yeah, I was the father in Malcolm in the Middle.
This is going to be the Mike Cranston story because you have it's an incredible story. I used to listen to you on radio when I lived in Edmonton.
That's right. I was in Edmonton in the early 70s, early to mid 70s.
Okay.
I was in Toronto in the mid to late 60s.
So where are you from?
I'm from Hamilton. And worked a lot of markets in Ontario, Sudbury, Guelph, Midland.
Mm-hmm. And, Midland.
Yeah.
So all the big metropolises.
Yeah, right. And then I didn't make my way to the Maritimes until 1979 when I came to work for CHNS AM.
And back then they had just the two stations, right?
They had
Brian Phillips on one, Mike Cranston on the other.
And the FMs were on the air, but, for example, Country 101 at that time was playing a lot of classical music.
Right.
I believe C100 was playing a lot of classical music, and, they certainly were not the powerhouses that they are today.
Isn't that where the announcers would go to learn how to be on radio?
Yeah. Yeah. And they did a lot of simulcasting too at that time.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's go back to when you started then, because you have a lot of neat stories about Toronto. You were just telling me before about you and The Who.
Yeah, I was working at Chum in Toronto, Chum AM, and which was really the leading rock station of its time, probably in Canada.
What were you doing there?
I was doing, I started doing a swing shift, weekend shift, and eventually worked my way up to doing early afternoons. My shift was 1 to 4 p.m., which was the best shift in the world, best shift I've ever had. You know, I mean, you talk about bankers' hours.
You could sleep
hours.
In, you could stay up
exactly.
late.
Exactly.
And a great shift for a station in Toronto, too.
Yeah.
How old were you?
I was 19, I guess. 19. Or no, I was married, so I must have been 21.
Why, they didn't allow you to get married before you were 21 back then?
No. No, but I was, I had worked my way up to this midday shift, and Herman's Hermits were coming to town, and Chum was presenting them at Maple Leaf Gardens. Mm-hmm. And the opening act for Herman's Hermits, believe it or not, was The Who. So
that changed.
But really,
hindsight,
they had a couple of hits. My Generation was their first hit, and I think Happy Jack or something was another hit.
Right.
It was before I Can See for Miles, and certainly long before the Tommy stuff. But I emceed the show at Maple Leaf Gardens. And I introduced The Who. I like to tell people that I introduced The Who to North America.
Which you did.
Yeah. And they came on and they did their thing, and nobody had ever seen anything like it. This is when they were destroying instruments on stage and setting guitars on fire and doing all of that kind of stuff. And after the show, their record rep had arranged for them to go to a major club in Toronto. I want to call it the Riviera. That's probably not what it was called. I can't remember the name of the place. But they arranged to have them go to this nightclub to see Benny King, who had been the lead singer with the Drifters and had a number of hits of his own. Of course, Stand By Me being the most famous.
Right.
And they had been very impressed to learn that Benny King was performing in Toronto because he had been a hero of theirs when they were young guys in England.
They love the American music over there.
And especially the blues. Mm-hmm. And so I was invited to go with them. So Roger Daltrey and Pete Townsend and the record rep and me all made our way to this club, and we saw Benny King do a set. And then after the set, he came and joined us at our table. So there I am sitting with these guys who were about to become huge legends of rock.
Yeah.
And they were they were super guys. They were very happy to be there to see Benny King. He was great. And we spent, I don't know, probably an hour and a half there. And then I made my way home to inform my wife that I'd just been out with the Who.
And she said, the Who?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Well, and they also became notorious for being bad boys.
Yes, they... And
did they do anything crazy at all?
Aside from setting fire to their guitars? No.
Nothing at the club, though? I
mean,
these
no.
guys were driving cars into swimming pools and...
Well, I think Keith Moon was the one who was doing most of that, but...
that night.
Yeah, probably.
While you were watching Benny King.
Exactly. But it was, I had a picture taken, as luck would have it. They took a picture of me backstage with the four members of The Who just before I went out to introduce them. So I've got that in one of my scrapbooks.
Oh, I've seen that picture. It's great.
Yeah. And I mean, I'm
holding the curtain there for them.
Exactly.
And, yeah.
And I look very young. They look very young. And it's fun to have.
Well, now that we're in this room surrounded by Beatles memorabilia, you have to have a Beatles story of some kind.
I do. I was in Guelph, Ontario, working at a station called CJOY, C-J-O-Y, and 1964, and the Beatles' first appearance in North America. They came over to do the Ed Sullivan Show, and their first tour of North America, Toronto was one of the locations.
Right.
So I got tickets, bought tickets, which I think were somewhere in the neighborhood of $5 or $6 at the time.
Yeah.
And
which would have been expensive back then.
It would have been, yeah. And myself and a guy that I worked with, Stan Chadwick at CJOY, we went off to Toronto to Maple Leaf Gardens to see the Beatles. And in those days, they would always have a press conference prior to their concert.
Mm-hmm.
So there we were, and we had press accreditation, and we were sitting there in the red seats of Maple Leaf Gardens, and there were about 300 or 400 other press people there. And out the Beatles come, and they sit in their chairs up at a table, and the press conference proceeded, and we just kind of were in awe. We sat and watched all of this unfold. And when the press conference was over, the Beatles stood up, left, went backstage, and most of the press guys left as well. And Stan and I were just sitting there talking, and all of a sudden we noticed some activity up on the stage.
Right.
And out comes Ringo Starr to do something to his drum kit. And he was over fumbling around with that. And then Paul McCartney walked out, and he walked from backstage, came right over to where we were, and just started talking to us. Now, you have to remember, this was their first trip to North America, so
right.
this was all very new to them. And he started talking to us and asking us what it was like to live in Toronto and one thing and another. Spent 10 or 15 minutes with us and then was called to go backstage, and so off he went. And Stan and I sit there looking at each other saying, my God, we just... spent 15 minutes with Paul McCartney. You know?
In the eye of the hurricane
exactly.
that was Beatlemania. Yeah.
And that's my big Beatles story. It was a real thrill. And then the concert itself, unless you have actually been involved in hearing 15,000 young teenage girls screaming at a high pitch, I mean, it's a phenomenon like you just would not believe. My ears were ringing for days after
could you hear
it was over.
Any of the music?
Occasionally you could hear a drum beat, like the bass drum, or very little of the concert could you actually hear.
Did they have a lot of opening acts, too? Because they only performed for like 20 minutes or something themselves.
So. I'm confused because I went to the 64 concert and I went to the 66 concert, and I can't remember who was the opening act. They had Jackie DeShannon.
Right.
I think that was the 66 concert. They had Clarence Frogman Henry.
All the big names.
I think he was in the 64, and they had Cannibal and the Headhunters.
Okay.
You ever hear them? Land of a Thousand Dances.
Oh, yeah.
That was their hit, and strong enough to be an opening act for the Beatles.
Great song, too.
Yeah.
So then as a young announcer, a young DJ, you made your way out west. Why?
Well, I had a family at that point. Mm-hmm. I had, there was my wife and my two kids. My daughter, I think, was about 4 and my son 2. And we were looking to the West as so many people are today as well.
Go West, young man.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And I had an opportunity to go and get into programming and as a program director in Prince George, B.C., so they had offered me a job, and so we thought we'd take a flyer on it, and off we went in our little Pinto station wagon driving through the Rockies. I didn't think it was going to make it through the Rockies.
Right.
And was in Prince George for about a year, and Edmonton came calling. A fellow by the name of Jim Edwards was the operations manager of CFRN at the time. Jim subsequently had a great career in politics.
Politics, yes.
Yeah. and I think is now the chancellor of the University of Alberta, or at least he was for a while.
Right.
But I went there as program director and morning man. So I had to wear two hats, and we stayed in Edmonton for close to 6 years.
Now, those are two tough hats to wear, because when you're doing the morning show, it messes up your time clock big time.
It sure does.
And then you've got to do like more or less a 9-to-5 job right after that.
Yeah, yeah. But it was interesting. I learned a lot in Edmonton. And our station was, we did pretty well. CHED was the big station, of course, at that time. And CFRN was probably number two or number three. And we also were affiliated with the TV station, CFRN Television.
Sunwapta Broadcasting.
That's right. Dr. Rice was the owner. And that was my first opportunity to do any television work.
Oh, what did you do there?
Well, I was the host of Search for Talent, which was, we go through Northern Alberta in a bus on the weekends and put on talent shows.
I didn't know you did that.
I did. You bet I did.
I remember that show.
Yeah. And I did a lot of commercial work on television then. Mm-hmm. And we were also affiliated with the Edmonton Oilers of the WHA.
Oh, yes.
When they started, before they joined the NHL. And I don't know if you recall, like 1972, obviously, the NHL stars went to Russia to play the Russians, and the Russians came here. Mm-hmm. 1974, it was the WHA.
I remember that very well.
And I went to several receptions and parties with the guys that were on that team, and it was fascinating
stuff. Big names. We're talking like Bobby Hull and Gordie Howe.
That's right.
And, wow, just the list goes on. There were some big name stars in the WHA.
Oh, yeah. One of my closest friends in Edmonton was the second string goalie for the Oilers. Chris Worthy was his name, and he played behind Jacques Plante for a period of time, and Dave Dryden, Ken Dryden's brother.
I remember those days very well.
Yeah, I got a real insight into what it was like to be involved with the hockey team.
And it's funny because a lot of the older players that made their careers in the NHL then went to the WHA, like Jacques Plante, Norm Ullman was on the Oilers back then well from the Leafs. And I remember those days. We had season tickets.
Yeah.
Of course, I was just a very young child at the time.
I was too.
So then, Mike, let's bring you here to Halifax.
I came to Halifax in 1979, and McLean Hunter owned the radio station at that time.
CHNX?
Yeah. And I had been negotiating with McLean Hunter to go to their station in Kitchener. They had hired me, in fact, and I was on my way to Kitchener. And then an opening came in Halifax, and they asked if I'd be interested in applying for that. And I said, well, sure, I've never been to Halifax. And so they flew myself and my wife here, and we had a fabulous weekend where I literally fell in love with the Maritimes and Halifax. And the general manager at that time was Hal Blackadar, who some people may recognize that name. He had been on the air for a period of time at CHNS and had become general manager, and he hired me. And so instead of going to Kitchener, we changed direction and came to Halifax. And
this was in 79?
79, yeah.
And you've been here ever since?
No. Left in 1986, went back to Ontario.
Okay.
And was working for Telemedia in Sudbury, Ontario, and doing the morning show there. Mm-hmm. And but only stayed in Ontario about 3 years and then came back to CHNS.
Once a Maritimer?
Yeah.
Always a Maritimer. So came back to CHNS. And then when, this is getting close to the time I first met you, when Sun FM booted up, you went over there.
I did. And I was with Sun FM for 6 years.
Where you invented James the Man in the Van.
The Man in the Van. And one of my favorite stories that I continue to tell people is when, like, that was a strong show. We had a really good morning show.
Yeah.
There was you and me and Paula Brecken. And you would go out at like 5 o'clock in the morning in the van and find interesting things to talk about. And I'll never forget the day that you knocked on Helena Bonham Carter's door at a hotel that she was staying at.
That's right.
This is Tim Burton's wife.
Mm-hmm.
And she was here making a movie, I think Margaret's Museum.
That's right.
Is that it? And anyway, you knock on her door, and I don't know if you had set it up in advance or what, but she let you into her hotel room to do an interview.
And she was wearing just a dressing gown.
Yeah. And it was fascinating. It was great stuff.
And she smoked like a chimney, too. That's
Did
the other
she?
Thing I remember about her. Yeah, every time I see her, and she's in so many movies now, I go, hey, I met her. I know. I spent the night. I woke up with her because she was not awake. She ordered coffee and it came up during the course of the morning show.
It was kind of an iffy project all the way along. I thought he's going to get his face slapped. The police are going to be called. This is going to get lucky. Crazy.
One or the other. I also did that with Denny Doherty. And the weird thing about Denny Doherty is somebody discovered, and I don't, might have been listening to us, but somebody discovered that Denny was there and the phone calls started coming in.
Yeah.
And it was amazing. I was spending time with a rock star. He was home. Halifax is his home, but he was also one of the mamas and papas. And all of these calls started coming through wanting to talk to Denny Doherty.
Right.
It was only after a while that I realized most of the calls were from little kids because he was the harbor master.
Theodore Tugboat.
Which brings me to another story, Mike Cranston. You were almost the harbor master on Theodore Tugboat.
I was. Yeah, I was down to the short list. I think there were three of us. And Denny won the audition. But I had gone and auditioned for it and was called back several times and just about got there, but not quite.
Would have been a great harbor master.
I think so.
He obviously pulled out the rock star card, and that's how he got
the
gig.
He was great in that role. He really was. My kids used to watch it, and they loved him. They loved him a lot more than they would have loved me.
You think maybe they would have loved me more if I was the harbor master.
Right.
Okay. So yeah, we had a lot of fun at Sun, and then when you left Sun FM, you went down to MBS.
I did.
So you went back to CHNS for a third time then.
And I became the news director through a strange series of events. Jim Crichton had been the news director, and he left, and they needed one, and I was just working weekends at the time. And they made me the news director.
And you've been doing that ever since?
I was until I retired, which was in 2010. And then I went back to work on a part-time basis in the news department in 2011.
So even though you've retired, we still hear your voice everywhere on all these commercials. Basically, you're taking all of our work from us. Thanks, Mike. Will you just retire already?
I will.
What was the most embarrassing thing that ever happened to you on radio?
Not that many things have happened that were embarrassing. One time when I was in Guelph in 1964, I can remember I was 18 years old, and the man who did the talk show was sick one day, and they asked me to fill in for him on the talk show. And
Completely unprepared.
Yeah, yeah, one of the components was a buy and sell kind of a feature.
Right.
People would call in if they had something to sell or they were looking for something. So here I'm trying to handle these calls, and this woman called, and a young-sounding woman, and she said, yes, I have a used fallopian tube for sale. And I'm 18. I had no idea what a fallopian tube was. So I just repeated it. I said, okay, this lady has a used fallopian tube for sale. Please call. You know, where I went.
Bad. Did she sell it?
I don't know. I don't know if she got rid of it or what happened. But
oh, that's funny.
Yeah, that was a little embarrassing.
You and I emceed some event. And I think drinking was involved as well, but we ended up at the casino.
Right.
And so we sat down at the blackjack table, and there was this big Neanderthal in between us. We couldn't sit beside each other at the table, so we started playing. And you said to the guy, hey, the guy there to your left, he thinks you're cheating. I almost got killed. Thank you, Mike. Many a time you've almost gotten me killed.
Right, no problem.
It is an absolute thrill, Mike, having you here. And I do have to thank you. We just kind of skimmed over the fact that you invented Man in the Van. But as a new father trying to get back into radio after a few years, I was just driving this community events van around and doing reports. That's kind of one of the first jobs that you get into in radio.
It was fun. You sounded great.
Well, you got me on the morning show, and I became a part of the morning show. And eventually, when you left the station, I sat in your chair and became the morning show. So and
was the chair damp at the time?
I didn't want to say anything, but thanks a lot for that. So thank you. I owe a lot to you, Mike Cranston, and I respect you so much.
Well, thanks for having me.
Thanks for dropping by the Beaver Bank Bunker. Now you can pick anything off the wall, and it's yours.
Okay.